Good morning, everyone. On behalf of Mind and Life Institute, I want to express our deepest thanks for welcoming our scientists and philosophers to Sarah Monastery, a vision that His Holiness had, I think it was 2013, where he brought to our attention that it was very important to come to this institution. And this is our 30th dialogue. 30 occasions where we have sat with His Holiness, scientists, philosophers, scholars, and contemplatives, investigating the relationship between Buddhism and science, and also the exchange that can happen between Buddhism and science. And somehow, Buddhist science and modern science. You know, I find the timing of this meeting particularly significant, that it comes on the heels of the climate accord, that we are facing global issues where we need to reach across the boundaries of our differences and to meet each other to create a future that is sane and livable for those who are coming in the future. So we also, at this time, want to acknowledge your dear friend, Francisco Varela, whose vision made it possible in a very powerful way for all of us to be together. And to greet Amy Varela, where are you, Amy, who is president of the board of Mind and Life Europe. And also the new president of the Mind and Life Institute, Dr. Susan Bauer-Wu, who is a clinician, a scientist, and an educator. So, Susan, you'll say a few words.
Shall I stand? Wonderful. I am so delighted to be here and welcome you all to the 30th dialogue, the Mind and Life Institute. And I first want to begin with a very sincere thank you to Your Holiness for your commitment, your inspiration to have these conversations, looking at the intersection of Buddhist science and modern science, with the overall intention and the eye toward alleviating suffering and promoting human flourishing. It is very fitting that we are here in this amazing monastery, Sarah Monastery, early 15th century monastery. How fitting it is for us to have this conversation in this place on this very auspicious day. And there are thousands, it's beautiful to see all the red robes here, thousands of monks and nuns here. And personally, it's very meaningful for me to be here for this particular conversation. And about 5 years ago, I was part of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, and I taught at Sarah College in Dharamsala. And the monks and the nuns that were there, I am so happy to see them again here today. So thank you so much. And finally, I want to give a very hearty thank you to the Dalai Lama Trust of India, and particularly who are the co-sponsors of this wonderful event, and particularly special acknowledgement to Mr. Jampo Londop for his wonderful organization who made it possible for us to be here. So I just welcome all of you, and may we enjoy this very special time together. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan, so much.
You have the slides.
So this morning we're going to have two sets of presentations. We'll begin with presentations by the neuroscientist Richie Davidson, a very close friend of His Holiness for many years, and the philosopher Jake Garfield. And they will enter into an exchange that will explore the relationship between perception, concept formation, and what we designate as a self, whether it's a narrative self, an embodied self, or a no self. And we're going to be plunging into this rich and deep area, but I think we're going to begin with a question. Jay? Mm-hmm. I think you're mic'd.
I'm mic'd. Yes. Thank
you. Oh, yeah. So, thank you. Your Holiness, we would appreciate some opening words from you.
For many years, many scientists we have together, collectively, collaboratively, from the point of view of the science, through empirical, for generations of investigations and the outcome, and still we to continue to foster towards which directions, good directions, and you have experience and deep experience. So we collectively, for many years, have discussed. We are discussing. It's really beneficial. Initially, so I think it will consume more time. But still, since many of you are new in this conference, many monks, you are new in this conference. So, if I introduce a little bit about the evolutions of this Mind and Life conference, then it might be beneficial. Say 30 years back, I felt that it is very important if we can discuss in depth with scientists. When I was young, I was very much interested in science. When I came to India, I used to read some books on science. And then to meet the scientists as a person, you know, I had a wish that if I meet the scientists as a person, then, and if we engage in meaningful discussion, then I thought it'll be happy. Slowly they began to meet with the scientists, and when I start meeting the scientists, generally speaking, most of the scientists, okay, they have no bias. Means that the depth scientists, the great scientists, they have the neutral stand, whereas the Tibetans, Tibetan monk Buddhist, many of them have they believe they have bias point of view, but the scientists, many great scientists, generally speaking, they have no bias, and. So for 30 years, we have had a discussion, so it's beneficial for both. It's mutually beneficial. So we as the Buddhist, particularly the concept of Nalanda, if we can flourish, if the new knowledge and information based on technology that have been dubbed by the great scientist, and the outcome of all those science and technology research, all the philosophies, preservation of the philosophies of the Nalandas, if they collaboratively discuss together, then I think it will be mutually beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
For the scientists, the generally most of the times they have been studying objectively. Most of the based on this study is objective. Aliyah, the object of studies generally it's objective, generally objective. I mean, the emotions is generally every people feel the emotions, the feelings, but when you try to study, but they haven't done, the great scientists haven't done the experiment on mind. So now the concept, okay, now through the deep traditions of the Indian traditions through Nalanda, and which is very deep and wide, and the scientists have really appreciated that, and scientists have really, thought that's a meaningful. So when two traditions meet together and discuss open-mindedly, in the beginning, initially, when I, shown interested, like discussions and experimentations, and slowly I thought, it is not, I have realized this is not for myself alone. So all those, the monks and nuns who study the Tibetan traditions, the Buddhist traditions, if they could engage in meaningful debate, then it will slowly, gradually, from the students, from the big monastics, institutions, if we can establish the basic education, okay, the science educational system there in the monastery itself, then from this monk students. And then when I had a discussion with some of the scientists, there are many scientists volunteer to come to the institution or these monastic institutions. Said, most of them have a common feeling that the monks in the monastic institution, even though they have been not exposed to the modern science, but still these monks, the young monks, have innovative, the sense of critical thinking and, critical and analytical thinking, it's in the state is high. So slowly we try to expand the study of science there in the monastery. So as per the interest, as per the wishes of the monastery itself, institution, then we slowly try to establish, even in the process of examination, there too, they will include in the curriculum. And so slowly there in Dharamsala, even in the West, during the science and meeting with the scientists, we organize meetings often. But if we organize meeting here in the monasteries, I thought it would be good. So 2 years back, in Drebung Monastery, we have organized such meeting there. At that time, it's a big learning institution where out there, when they try to, went round to look after, to find out what's going on around the monastery. So they thought, they have observed the monks engage in dialectics, debate. When they were trying to, debate with the analytic dialectic systems, so they were very much impressed. And the scientists who went round to observe the engagement of monks in the Tibetan dialectics, they were very much interested. And then that monk, and then one scientist, while they were having in the casual discussions, he shows the jasha as if he's been engaged in dialectics, Tibetan dialectics. Earlier in Dharamsala, when we had a meeting, when we had a discussion, some scientists, the Nalanda, logics, some of them have even inquired, isn't it possible to introduce this dialectics in other disciplines of education? So I had this meaning, even initially in the 60s, I had that vision, but because of the lack of good teachers and then the administrators, they haven't taken much initiatives. the firmly, they haven't initiated much on this wish of His Holiness that to introduce the dialectics in the Tibetan community. But recently, now even in the schools, we have introduced this dialectic of the education system. It's been introduced already now into the schools in Himachal, particularly from Ladakh to Mon. Now through dialectics, now they have developed new interest. Recently, when I went to Ladakh, some students, the school students, they debated through Tibetan style, and there amongst the students, there were Muslim students also. From the point of view of educational perspective, it is not from the religious point of view, to help, masses, to help the people in general. So that's why I mentioned earlier, it is not a Buddhist the religion, but it is a Buddhist science. Initially, I emphasized that Buddhist science, but it is not Buddhist religion. It's from the explained through the Buddhist philosophy and the Buddhism, but particularly in Buddhist science, not Buddhist religion. Science has no discriminations of race, culture. So it is for the humanity in general, for the benefit of the humanity. So if we as a very few, and that too, the follow of Matiyamika, and the very few, it's not to foster the knowledge within that small group. But we are talking verbally, we say that the whole sentient beings, but in reality, but not only just praying, but practically, is there a way to help the sentient beings practically, not just in prayers? So I've been realizing it often. I've been thinking on this thing, because there's a limitless, endless sentient beings. They are limitless and endless, but we could just pray. But this global, on this earth, there are different varieties of culture, the creatures, insects, birds, animals. Even though we have that feeling of helping them, how could we do? Because they all, all the living creatures, they prefer peace, but not harm. But still, how could we help? Say the fishes in the water. Say, for example, if the fish is out of the water, what could we do is we could put back into the water. But the greater hope, of course, that the human beings, the human creature, the sentient beings, Homo sapiens, there, at least we have a religion, but they have intelligence. So there's a hope of making some difference. There are 7 billion people in this world. We'll be able to help them. Not in a great sense, but in a small way. In this world, most of the trouble, the problems are caused by the human beings. It's an anthropogenic agent. These problems are created by the human being, and then we cannot just sit there idle and pray to the God and say that help to remove this problem. Say, for example, the Tibetans, somehow in the past we have neglected something, and then because of that we are suffering the problem. Now we cannot sit idle and say pray to God, Lord Buddha, and say that please try to eradicate all this problem, to remove this problem. No. Now we all, the religious people, we all are praying to, the different God, and then God, if you believe in God, praying to the God, God might, if you can meet God, God might say that you have created the problem, we haven't created the problem. And then if God has created the problem, then it's okay if you can really pray to God and say that, help us and to remove the problem. But the problem has been created by the human being themselves, so for the responsibility also lies on the human beings to solve the problem. By praying to God, the God might say, if you meet the God, he might remind you that it is your creation, the problem, and your responsibility to remove them. We as the Tibetans, when we say, okay, the whole sentient being, we are not talking about the Tibetans in particular. Okay, so if we let all sentient beings, leave it for aside, and we'll discuss on this. Okay, we focus on to the human beings on this earth. Now, it is high time to think. If when we say that the sentient being, when we pray for the whole sentient being, if it is not a fold, if it is not a phony, then if you're really from the deep of our earth, if you're really thinking for the good and this good, the well-being of the sentient being, then if it is genuine, if it is truth, then as far as possible, we have to put into practice. Say, for example, Bodhisattva, just, you know, developing that feeling, emotion, is not sufficient. You have to put into the action. Therefore, the whole sentient beings, in order to benefit the whole sentient beings, it is not necessary, okay, the religion, so the linking it to the different cultural religion, then different countries or the different nations have a different religion. However, where we are lacking is common, the ethics, moralities that could help, that could be, you know, like beneficial for all. Therefore, they're the old traditions of Indian traditions of mind psychology. It's very rich. So the preservation, I think the Tibetan, we as a Tibetans, we are the only, okay, the group of people, you know, who could conserve that age-old Indian traditions. And mainly that dialectics, the logic, epistemology, that field of learning, okay, is still existing in the Tibetan culture for 20. Of course, the many, maybe many in many culture they are studying, but here at a stretch, longitudinal study for about 20, 30 years, I think it is available. That exists only in the Tibetan Buddhist monastic institution. So till that, our scholars in the past have painstakingly translated Sanskrit and Tibetan, and it could be explained in detail, in depth, through the language of Tibetans. Now we have this rich culture, all been translated by the scholars in the past. Now we have to concentrate and we have to put all our effort and study. Now it's high time to think. That's why now when I meet the great scientists, I meet often many scientists, when I talk about the psychology from the point of view of the Buddhist philosophy, when I explain, then it really benefits them. It's not from the point of view of the spiritual or religious point of view, but from the ethical point of view, the morality, and for the whole human being, it's really beneficial. That's why. So you scientists, we listen to when the scientists explain, we listen to them. Or this, when the scientists are here, collectively discussing, engage in discussing, the environment will be different. And when, listen to the Buddhist point of view, and now this is the 30th meeting, the Mind and Life Conference. So Varela, he was the one who pioneered, who initiated, and others also, the lady that the president, now she's a bit, weak, physically weak, now the time has gone, but they have initially the work very, very hard, they have really contributed, now this is the, by the time when the conference goes to 35th and the 40th, maybe, many of us will not be here, will be gone, but this institution will remain, the process will remain till the sentient beings, so long as the sentient beings remain, so we should continue to with this the concept of helping others. We should continue with it, even though the Lord Buddha and all have gone, but their essence of the teachings are still existing. This is since it helps the living a happy life for many. So therefore, it's very, very, very beneficial for the humanity in general. Therefore, Mind and Life institutions for in this modern. We started in the beginning of the 20th century. Now this is we are in the 21st century. We are continuing. Most probably, it will continue the 22nd century. Even it can extend to the 20th century. It can continue to the 22nd century. So because it's good, it's beneficial for the general people. Slowly, it will extend. We hope that it will slowly extend. It will become global. Since we all know nobody likes pain. Well, everybody likes happiness. So we are not talking about the hell and heaven, but when you are surviving, sustaining your life in this earth, we are talking about, okay, happiness. So since we all human beings, the seven billions, all the same, we were born in the same style, whether you are a king, whether you are a great lamas, whether you are a beggar, or a vagabond, at the time when we were born, we were the same. When we die at the time of death, okay, we were the same. So when we were, but at the birth, when scientists have discovered some base, the scientific base they have learned, okay, maybe they will explain later, okay, at the time of the birth when we're young, okay, compassionate, okay, it's by nature, intrinsically, we are compassionate, we love compassion, we need compassion. The intrinsic nature of the human being itself, it's love and compassion. It's not, if it is evil, intrinsically, if by our intrinsic value it's hatred, then I think there's no point of discussion, engaging discussion, we should leave it. Since our nature, the intrinsic nature itself is love and compassion, since now we need to, it is very clear when we were young, but as we mature, as we get educated, now we should introduce this, since in the educational system, mostly in the West, it's not there. Now, when we talk about the compassions and the kindness and love, at once we refer it to the religious institution. And this is where we're lacking. But in general, when we were a young infant, it's naturally we have no bias. We do not discriminate between race, culture, or color. Now, as when we were young, we play. We love to play. Love one another, but as we mature, as we become older, so-called, educated, then all the killings, all the hatreds, all the, this has gone. Here, in case of a little bit, because of the temporary weather, he's hot, the little problem. Otherwise, we all have, in peace. We are all in peace. So this very day, the very now instant, the killing is going on out there in the world. Okay, if it has been killed, if the people have been killed by the, wild animals like lions and tigers, then okay, that's another issue. But here, human being killing another human being out of hatred, then that is really sad. It's a great disappointment. With this attitude, with this feeling, I think human being on this earth will never be happy. Now, I think there's a solution to solve this problem. Since we are naturally built with love and compassion, then there's a solution to solve this human-to-human hatred and harmfulness. Now, there's a solution. So we should think in deep in this, and thank you so much.
So our friend Richie Davidson will open up the meeting with comments on setting the context. How did this subject matter come into being for this particular meeting?
Son?
Yes.
Your Holiness, thank you so much for your continued involvement and interaction with scientists. As we have told you on many occasions, you have been such a great inspiration for a whole generation of scientists. And as a consequence, it's my conviction that the scientific enterprise in at least certain areas of science is changing in a very positive way as a consequence of our interactions with Your Holiness. This morning, in this short session, we will showcase some of the major ideas that will be discussed in more detail throughout the meeting. Before we get to that, I wanted to just recall a little bit of the history of mind and life and follow some of the comments that Your Holiness made. We had our very first public meeting in 2003 with you at MIT. And in many ways, that was a coming out for Mind and Life. It was the first time Mind and Life went public, so to speak. And we had a number of very influential scientists, including some Nobel laureates, who were participating with us at MIT. And this was the occasion for a much wider recognition of the importance of the work that we've been collectively doing. And I'd like to just identify a few major developments in modern science, which I think have enabled the dialogue to be as fruitful as it has been. And two of those, which I think have been so important, are these. One is our increased knowledge of plasticity, the plasticity in the brain, and also plasticity in our genome, the extent to which genes can be, the expression of genes can be modified by experience and by training. That idea is an idea which has enabled us, has enabled scientists to identify mechanisms that with which they are familiar that relate to some of the mind training practices that we have encountered in Buddhism, in Buddhist science. And that has, I think, facilitated this important dialogue. The other major development is one... The other major development is one that Your Holiness has been mentioning several times this morning, and that is this idea of innate basic goodness. And there's more and more scientific evidence, and Matthieu Lau later in the meeting will talk more about some of the scientific evidence that relates to this, but this is a very powerful concept which is gaining more and more credibility in the mainstream scientific world. And that has promoted, I think, a very important connection between modern, particularly behavioral scientific research and Buddhist science. So, Your Holiness, we'd like now to move on and begin to showcase some of the issues that we'll discuss this week. But before we do that, we wanted to begin with the question of motivation. You frequently ask us at the beginning of dialogues or the beginning of a consideration of a topic, what is our motivation for engaging in this work? And that's really where we'd like to begin.
Do you want to start? So, Jay.
Am I on?
Yes.
I'm on. So, Your Holiness, thank you very much for a very eloquent statement of your own motivation for entering into these dialogues and for bringing these dialogues to Sera Monastery, which I think is a wonderful place to be. But we also wanted to talk more specifically about the motivations for talking about perception, concepts, and the self, and why would we begin there. And so, speaking from my own heart as a philosopher, why do I care about perception, concepts, and the self, and why do I think we should care? Well, one reason, of course, is that these are three of the potential sources of suffering in the world, very deep potential individual sources, and sources about which we can do something. When we think about perceiving the world, many of us take the world quite naturally to be given to us just as our perceptual apparatus gives it to us, that we just see the world as it is, and we then don't distinguish between our own experience and reality. We don't distinguish in conceptuality between what the world is like and the conceptual superimpositions we bring to it. And most deeply, when we think about who we are, we confuse a conventional designated self with a real self, with a substantial self, and we act as though we are independent beings who see the world just as it is, who see other people just as they are, and whose concepts reflect reality just as it is. My own feeling is that that is the deepest possible source of suffering. And that if by engaging philosophically and analytically, analytically and scientifically, we can remove that source and create a more realistic view of the kind of people we are, of our relationship to reality, and of the role of our own conceptualization, that is a fundamental step to alleviating suffering. I also think that this is an area in which both Buddhist and Western philosophy have engaged in very deep analysis. And so it is a very fine area in which we can bring the Buddhist and the Western philosophical worlds, not just scientific worlds, into dialogue. Because I think it is very important for us to remember that cultural dialogue, and especially ethical and moral progress of the kind Your Holiness has so eloquently advanced, often comes from philosophical reflection and the humanities in conjunction with science. And I think that these are three areas in which philosophy, both Western and Tibetan, can join with science to make real progress. So that is why we bring these three topics to the table here at SARA.
So, Richie, if you could begin to lay out some of the science, what's being done and how it's being done, of these three braided areas, that would be helpful.
Okay. Before we get there, I'd like to just amplify one little component about motivation, Your Holiness. One of the things that we've been observing in the West, I think Your Holiness had a vision of this before we really understood how it would play out. Because science is valued in the West, because it has an important currency, we are finding that as a consequence of the scientific research that has been catalyzed by our dialogues, by Mind and Life, there is real change that is occurring in a practical way. There is change in our institutions of education. There's increased recognition of the importance of social and emotional learning, of cultivating warm-heartedness, cultivating skills of self-awareness. There are now more than 25 states in the United States, I think it's up to 27, where it is legally mandated that children from K through 12 be taught some form of social and emotional learning. This is in part a consequence of the kind of research that has been stimulated by these dialogues. So there are real practical changes that are occurring. In the area of healthcare, there's increased recognition that many of the chronic illnesses of our society are illnesses which are in part due to our minds, due to our emotions. It's not necessarily the fundamental cause, but it is a contributing cause. It can exacerbate the symptoms of these illnesses and as a consequence exact tremendous burden on our society with healthcare costs that are skyrocketing. And there's growing recognition in the biomedical community that training the mind may be valuable for helping with chronic medical illnesses, to help reduce the severity of the symptoms, to help decrease, ultimately, healthcare costs. And so I think that this is something, again, of real practical benefit and is part of our motivation for continuing this work and feeling that this work is really so central to so many of the major problems that are facing our culture today. So at this point, I think we can move on and begin to address the specifics of the topics, perception, concepts, and the self. And we're going to begin with setting the context. And Jay, from the both Western philosophical and from the Buddhist traditions will begin to describe how each of these concepts has been central to these traditions. It'll go on in a minute.
Hello?
Okay, you're on. You're
now on. I'm on. Now I'm on. And of course, Your Holiness, I am keenly aware that for me to be talking to you about Buddhist philosophy is a bit foolish. You know far more than I do. But what I would like to talk about are the ways in which the Buddhist and the Western traditions converge on these ideas. Because again, I think that this is a place for very fruitful dialogue and collaboration. So we are thinking about perception and concepts because, of course, perception and inference are the two fundamental ways we know about the world, the two tseni. And insofar as those are the two great pramanas that we use, it is important for us to understand how those work, what the relationships between them are. But it's also important to see that when we think of perception as the grasping of what is in the world by the mind, that it then turns over to concepts, we have to understand that the boundary between perception and conception is not always very clear. And so part of what we need to do in this discussion is to investigate just how far perception itself may be conceptually informed and just how much concepts are themselves imbued by perception. So as we look at this from a Buddhist point of view, we see a very firm distinction drawn between inference. And so we will be taking seriously the idea that perception may be in fact determined by concepts in part, and that our concepts may involve perceptual components. But each of these is also deeply involved in the way that we experience and think about ourselves. Because it's very easy to think that I just look inside and I see, oh, there's a self there. That's who I am. And then we think that because I've perceived it, it must be real. And then we are on the road to reifying the self, taking ourselves as substantial entities, taking others as different, taking egoism as a reasonable position, and the whole mass of suffering gets going. If we can look at the very different roles of perception and conception in apprehension of the self, and realize that what might seem to be perceived is in fact a conceptual superimposition, then we might be on the way to deconstructing the self and to moving towards a notion of no self. And so for these reasons, we see these three concepts as very, very closely related. And that's very useful to bring them here, as I said, because each of these, as you well know, is central to Buddhist philosophy. You can't do Buddhist philosophy without thinking about perception, without thinking about inference, without thinking... But it's also important that to remember that each of these and reflections on each of these ideas is central to Western philosophy as well, and that throughout the history of Western philosophy, from its earliest period, people have investigated perception, people have investigated inference, and people have developed theories about the self, and that philosophical reflection has formed much of the foundation for contemporary cognitive science. So I think that not only to engage in real meaningful dialogue between Western and Tibetan culture, but also even to understand Western science, we need to understand its foundations in Western philosophy. And for that reason, these are three very good places to look.
So Richie, could you go into some of the science?
Let you advance us through.
We can do that. We're going to skip around in the slides to get to the science part. So from the... One of the questions that Jay raised is a fundamental question. Where are the boundaries among these different ideas, these different entities? And so the question of where does sensation end and perception begin is a question that has been central to Western philosophy and to behavioral and neural science. Another issue that Jay alluded to in science, we talk about what we call top-down and bottom-up processes. And what we mean by this is that something very basic, a very basic mechanism of perception, may be influenced by our beliefs. It may be influenced by our emotions. And if it's influenced by our beliefs or influenced by our emotions, we would say that that is a top-down influence. Yeah. It is, and we refer to bottom-up and top-down because the brain is on top. And the most recent areas of the brain that have developed over the course of evolution is the cerebral cortex at the top of the brain. So that's where the term top-down has come from. And bottom-up refers to our senses begin at the eyes, the ears, and that's more on the bottom. And the information then goes up. And so we can talk about the interplay between our beliefs and our emotions, which is top-down. And in terms of bottom-up, we know that the human eye, for example, or the human ear, is sensitive to different wavelengths or different frequencies compared to the eye or an ear of another species. And so this constrains the kind of information that actually gets into the nervous system, and that would be referred to as a bottom-up influence because it's an influence from the very basic mechanisms of our sensory apparatus. And so those two components are always interacting, and they together will constrain and influence what we actually perceive. So one of the...
But I mean, even though you speak of bottom-up influence, but the sensory experiences are connected with the brain processes.
Sure. So the
brain.
Yes.
Cannot perform.
Yes, that is absolutely true. So the eyes and the ears communicate to the brain, and that is how we're able to perceive. And so these bottom-up structures have direct connections to the brain. They're literally part of the brain. They're a peripheral extension of the brain.
So
imagine. So looking at this top-down and bottom-up processes from the perspective of Indic tradition, the classical Indian Buddhist and Indian tradition, we would look at this contrast as that between the mental and the sensorial. So top-down would be from the mental to the sensorial,
yes,
and from the bottom-up would be from the sensorial to the mental.
Yeah. Same idea.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly the same. Did you want to say something?
That is exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
So one way to think about this is that Richie is talking about the variety of causes and conditions that are involved in the construction of a representation, of an appearance in perception, that some of those are coming from the intention, some of those are coming from mental factors, some of those are coming from antecedent mental states, some of them are coming from our purposes, Some of them are coming from the external world through our senses, not directly, but mediated by our sense faculties. And so that even though we may have the experience in perception that we're just sitting back and seeing the world exactly as it is being constructed always by processes that include cognitive processes as well as sensory processes. And one of the fundamental errors we can fall into is to confuse something that we constructed with something we just happened to find.
So one example, a simple example of top-down influences is emotions influencing perception. And a simple example, Your Holiness, is if there was a situation which made a person angry, and then they saw an unrelated neutral face, just somebody's face, a picture of somebody's face, and if you ask them, how happy is that person? Or if you ask them, how much do you trust that person? If they have just been made angry, they will likely report that face to be less happy, to be less trustworthy, and to show less liking of that individual, even though it's completely unrelated to the episode which caused them the anger in the first place. And so that is an example, a simple everyday example, which also has been confirmed in the laboratory, of how emotions can actually influence the perception of a person's face. We can see how that can color our interactions with others in important ways.
So the term emotion wouldn't be used for the five sensory experiences themselves. The emotion.
Sensory is the feeling of consciousness of mind. Some conditions with emotion.
Yes, the emotions can influence those. And that's influence.
Themselves are not.
No, itself is different. But this is where the interaction is between. Between the mental and the sense. And the sense.
No. So this is similar in the Buddhist thinking as well, that the sensory experiences and emotions are distinct.
Yes.
One can influence the other, but.
Yes, one can influence the other.
This is top.
So its emotions are more top down.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Part of the top down process.
Bottom up, Chani. Emotion, care is what you.
That is, and the sensory, the bottom-up, there could be influences for the rising of emotions.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, it goes both ways.
However, I think that we don't want to distinguish them too far, because the example that Richie gave was an example of face perception. So if I am in an angry state and I see that neutral face, I experience myself as perceiving unhappiness in that face, not as perceiving a neutral face and then inferring unhappiness. So the illusion of perceptual experience, or the perceptual, my sensibility about perception, is very tightly involved in emotion. And we can think of that as a union that is so tight that it's sometimes difficult to say where one begins and the other one ends. And that interplay, that interdependence, I think, is more important than keeping them distinct.
So part of the challenge arises from the fact that these processes are so quick.
Yes.
And it seems as if, you know, the kind of the biased perception you have is actually the perception of that object in front of you. But what is actually happening is there is a top-down influence. Mm-hmm. But because the processes are so quick, we tend to conflate them.
That's right.
Scientific experiments where measures of brain activity that have very good temporal resolution are used, brain electrical activity, you can see an influence of an emotion on, for example, face perception within 90 milliseconds.
Yes.
So very, less than a tenth of a second.
Yes.
Very fast, yeah. So one of the major questions is the question of whether perception is necessarily constructive. And by that we mean that the mind and the brain is always recreating a representation of the world outside or the world inside, and it leads to a question of whether there is any such thing as a veridical perception, that is, perceiving something as it is. We would be...
유치다워신도 제마 나는데 테레봉은 때베나 왕시의 그 강력이 제베네 그 내가 먹고 싶은 제원도 갈라 다 그 즉 넘버를 제파 고유직 제제 제샤마도 유치다워신도 수 멜론 차원하신게 제그여버지 셰카보시브르샤스
Counsel or advice about this particular question, whether perception can ever be veridical, whether the mind can ever perceive something actually as it is. I am very dimly aware of some Buddhist ideas in the Dzogchen tradition of perceiving directly the nature of mind. And we would be interested in Your Holiness's comments on this question and whether there is such a thing as veridical perception from Buddhist science.
유치다워신도 유치다워신도 제베게 또 시에바지 낭주원의 샤교로 와서 단 세리부 고란조 땅도 갈라데 뇨르타부시 브레샤스 데 낭주원의 시에벤들은 그
시바랑
The point about the Dzogchen that you're referring to is really more to do with understanding the nature of mind itself. Mm-hmm. Whereas we're talking about understanding reality, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, so...
Separate.
Other
phenomena. So the Dzogchen's, statement is more about the mind itself. Mm-hmm. It's not about reality.
Yeah, okay.
So one question to just push this a little bit further. Many people in the philosophical world think that the idea of veridical perception may not even mean anything, because whenever we're having perceptual experience, it's an experience constructed in our brain as a result of the impact of the external world upon us, and so what we construct is a construction, and there's nothing that we could even imagine matching it to. The world looks very differently to me than it does to a dog, than it does to another kind of a being, and we can only ask how the world looks to us. But if we take that and we apply that to inner sense experience, to our experience of our own mind, to our experience of our own emotions or our own sensations, then the question to be raised, and I think a very difficult question, is the Yiwangshe just as subject to illusion, just as constructive as the external sense faculties? And so when I experience my own mind or my own inner states, am I again only experiencing an appearance of my inner states, only experiencing an appearance of my mind, or can we make sense of veridical perception of the mind to a greater degree than we can experience of the external world? Some people might think the mind is more apparent to us and more directly available. Others might think that it's perceived just as the external world is.
At the river two tang by yena, Nangin yong tole, some tang by yene, 강산 수수용원이나 수수용 영화도 삼당이 되고 다들 지다오시는게 또구도 삼삼질로 차대 차기 어때 이내 지삼디 수수 나와파 유일까봐 인다 지삼 고유 덴바 추제바 인데 임지 당하고 지그러 와서 다들 지두고 아니 유치다오시도 제베 참아세지 자네 샤마도 이제 강한 태그도스
So the point is, for example, whatever you know phenomenon you take up, it has tremendous amount of attributes, mm-hmm. aspects to it. So when you experience and perceive something, you know there's no way you can perceive it in entirety. Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be selective. So this is where it the mental. Kind of, you know, processing comes in.
Mm-hmm.
In epistemology, pramana, the language and the conceptual thoughts engage by excluding through an exclusion process. Therefore, when it engages with the object, it selects.
In Buddhist epistemological thinking, we make distinctions between the way in which...
I think better to say ancient Indian psychology.
Epistemology.
Awareness, like that. So would it be...
There was a lot of discussion in classical Indian philosophy about the way in which, you know, thought relate to the world and perception. How is that different from kind of direct perception? And, you know, there were proponents who argue for a much greater synergy and similarity between the way in which perceptual processes and thought processes relate to the world versus the Buddhists such as Dignaga and Dhammakirti who critique this and would argue that thoughts engage with reality in a very different way. Thoughts are always selective because, you know, things will have multiple properties and thoughts will be selective and, you know, eliminate what it is not interested in, pick out specific attributes and engage with that aspect of reality, whereas perceptual experience is more of a kind of a, you know, being aware, simple perception of the thing itself. And all the attribution of the properties and so on is subsequent to that initial perceptual experience. And that's when the thought comes in, the construction comes in.
So would there, on that basis, would there be an argument that there is no constructive process in that initial brief period? And the construction occurs subsequently?
Di yun se di la, ani to chue pa di kiyo mara di.
So, again here, it's very difficult to actually distinguish because the processes are so fast. And also, it varies according to individual's habituation to whatever is being attended to.
But it
time factor.
Larian.
Also, you see, training of mind.
Yes.
Also, you see, very, very helpful.
Yeah.
Sometimes you see.
The sound guy is just not paying attention.
Training of mind, actually. Sharpening off.
You need to keep an eye.
So that also, you see, very. I think maybe sort of that.
It's
not working. I think maybe a little bit, I think
It's on now.
Not appropriate. But sometimes you see, eye consciousness, my eye consciousness is not very sort of clear. Some other very clear. But I think there are some sort of connection, the brain, top, down. So, although you see things not very clear, but the detailed thing, I notice immediately. When I mentioned that, there's some other, still not yet sort of, kasoda, clear.
Oh, well, lam, what kind of clarity of information you can take out of the perceptual experience, which is where the mental, you know, element comes in, really seems to depend a lot on the individual's capability and how much you attend to, how much you are familiar with it, and the clarity of your own mind. Mm-hmm. So some individuals in particular area will be able to, you know, see a lot more attributes with greater clarity subsequent to the actual perceptual experience.
Yeah, I think the key theoretical issue from the scientific perspective is whether even in any human being, if there is a moment that precedes the
construction.
The construction. That really is the key issue. And so we would be interested in Your Holiness's comment on whether it is possible even for a particular person with the right kind of mind training to have that single moment, even if it's very, very brief, where there is unconstructed.
This is me. I was suggesting to His Holiness, part of the problem really is coming from semantics, because the way in which the term perception is being used by scientists seems to be quite different from the way in which the term perception would be used by Indic philosophers, such as Buddhists. Mm-hmm. And when we use the word construction, there could be a purely perceptual level of construction, where, for example, Dhammakirti has this idea of akar, which is the imprint. So the image, the phenomenal image of the object, which is a construct, but it is not a mental construct, and it has no element of thought involved. So I think even the term construction is problematic.
Yeah. As is the term concept, which is also used.
I always telling you, see, expressing knowledge about, you see, the whole sort of system of mind or emotion. That is something very important. So ancient Indian sort of psychology, quite detailed sort of
explanation, distinctions.
So
there's a much greater level of clarity of differentiations in the classical Indian epistemology and thinking.
So, yeah, naturally, the word English, in English
yeah.
Words not adequate. That's very clear.
Not it. Yes.
We should move to concept.
Yeah. So, Your Holiness, we're going to move on to concepts now in the interests of time. And we will, over the next few days, talk about how concepts are defined in both psychology and neuroscience. One of the questions which neuroscientists have considered is how concepts are actually represented in the brain. And here there's actually some very interesting...
똑바르셔야 되지. 되는지 된지 세져 봐. 말아도 된지 세들. conceptuals 라면 똑바르셔. concepts 라면 똑바르셔야 된지 세져.
And we should be very clear here that the word concept in English is also a word with many different meanings and understandings, and it won't match Tokpa completely. So whereas in the Buddhist standpoint, we think always of a concept as something that gathers many things under it, that's suitable for language, that's repeatable. In the Western sense, it may be a little bit more abstract. It may have more knowledge involved. And it also may constitute more a capacity, a cognitive capacity, than a simple set of knowledge. And so there are many different understandings of concept, both in the Western tradition and the Buddhist tradition. And one of the things that I'm hoping over this week that we pay very careful attention to is never to use the term without saying exactly what we mean by it, because it will be very easy to think that we're talking about the same thing and to talk past each other.
So even say, for example, within the Buddhist tradition itself, the way in which the term perception, which we translate as perception, munsum or pratyaksha, is used differently. Say, for example, between the Dharmakirtian school on the one side and the Madhyamakas on the other.
Exactly.
The same term, but used differently.
Exactly. Same problem in the West, and then multiplied when we interact with the West and Buddhism.
One of the other issues which is pertinent here, and Jay and I have discussed this in advance of the meeting, is the extent to which concepts both depend on language as well as are reportable in language. And so there's a very famous experiment in psychology that was done many years ago, and the title of the article was Concept Formation in Pigeons. And pigeons were taught to learn a concept of a human face. And they were taught that by repeated exemplars of human faces. And they were able to show, the experimenters were able to show that the pigeons had a rudimentary concept of a face, and they actually responded to complex pictures that involved human faces in a way which actually was more sensitive than humans, because their eyesight in certain ways is more acute. But this is an example of how psychologists have studied this in a variety of species in a variety of different ways.
You have some of the images?
Pardon?
I thought you had some of the images. Did you have some of the images of the pigeon experiment?
No, we don't have videos of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I believe those animals, their survival is very much depend on sensorial sort of
activity.
So eyesight, hearing, some of the animals much stronger than we human beings. Mm-hmm. Suppose to see we totally believe or relying on our this sophisticated mind,
brain,
but sometimes you see, it go wrong. Then a lot of troubles there.
One of the issues which we'll discuss later in the week, and Laura will be talking a lot about this, and how language can sculpt, can influence our formation of concepts. And this is her central area of expertise. And so we'll learn a lot more about that later in the week with examples from many different languages. So I think we should move on now to the self.
Okay.
In the interests of time. So, Jay, maybe you should begin by introducing this from the Western philosophical and Buddhist perspective.
Sure. I'll be talking more about the self with Geshe Eshe Tapgyala on Wednesday. But when we talk about the self, My own view is, and this draws partly on my understanding of Buddhist philosophy, partly on my background in Western philosophy, that we have to be careful, very careful, to distinguish a number of things. One is our experience of self, the feeling that we have of I, the feeling that I exist. A second is the basis of that feeling, the causal bases. What are the sensations or the thoughts or the concepts that give rise to that? Another one is what we take that self to be, the substantial imputed self that we grasp. And a fourth one is the conventionally existent person that we have to take seriously. And so if we're not careful, again, to distinguish experience of self from what causes the experience of self, to the self that we posit, from the person that we are, we get into tremendous confusions. So when we look at these scientific questions and ask how the self is regarded in psychology and neuroscience, the first thing we have to ask is whether, when we're asking that question, we're really talking about the self or the experience of self, or whether we're really talking about the conventional person or the basis of designation. Sometimes neuroscientists are talking about one of those, sometimes another. Personally, I don't think they can ever be talking about the self, because I don't think a self exists. And they don't think they're talking about non-existent things. But they can tell us a great deal about the processes that lead us to posit such a self, even through illusion. And they can also tell us about the processes that underlie the construction of the conventional person. So we have to be very careful in these discussions to keep those things apart. And again, the distinctions, I think, are drawn most sharply in the Buddhist tradition by Dawatakpa and others, but are also drawn in the Western tradition, and we can use those two together to make sense of these. Do you want to continue?
Sure. Das kansas self life de gor tanye chipam bung ton pe ju chigores din za tanye chipam chipam ko ton pe ju gol ya ko yemje ya bu tam ma tu be na ye ko ko le
When I speak, Your Holiness, I'm going to try to be very careful to always use person or gangsak to talk about the conventional person, and always use self or dak to talk about the substantial self that is posited and is the object of negation, just to keep those apart and clear following Chandrakirti's usage.
So, Your Holiness, in modern neuroscientific research, there is a phenomenon which has been now very well characterized and studied more and more often, and it's called the default mode. What the default mode is if you place a person in an MRI scanner and you do not give them any explicit instruction and just have them lie in the scanner, there are activations in the brain that are observed which are not random. They constitute a specific pattern. And that's been studied in many different ways now. And that pattern tends to be consistent within a person. And one of the...
Within, not across. Not across.
More within than within, across.
Than the default mode.
Now, the way this was initially discovered was quite interesting.
Not him. What about... the age factor or in health? I mean, does it make a difference within the person?
All of these are being studied. They will play some role, yes. But within an age, and certainly within a person, there is some consistency to these patterns. And the way this was discovered was very interesting. It was discovered in the following way. If a person is engaged in a very difficult cognitive task, for example, if their memory is being taxed by some task which requires them to remember, for example, if I give you a phone number, 7 or 10 digits, and I tell you that in 2 minutes I'm going to ask you what that phone number is, your mind would be rehearsing it. And so the mind is quite active on a very specific task. And there are a set of circuits in the brain that become deactivated when you're engaged in that very difficult cognitive task.
That is an function of being more focused.
Being
more focused.
Yes, to some extent, absolutely. Yes. And so the interesting thing, though, is that when the mind is more relaxed, it's not focused, then this activity becomes more prominent. And it turns out that some of this activity seems to be related to what psychologists and neuroscientists have called a narrative self.
Narrative self,
So the narrative self is the...
So Solon is wondering this. So regardless of whether the person consciously attributes self or not, but any memory of the person's experience is going to be self-referential.
Exactly.
So,
animal, they do not know conception.
Concept of I, yeah. So the animals have no idea of the distinction between self-perception, concept, and so on.
Well, we'll talk about that.
But it's a very, very tiny insect. You see,
mosquito doesn't.
Moving. There's a feeling of self.
There's a feeling of self. There's a feeling of self. A sense of...
In any species.
Yes.
Anyone.
Yeah.
So maybe you want to explain what you mean by narrative self.
Yeah, so by... Yeah. Do you want to...
You want to talk about narrative a little bit?
Sure, please.
So when we talk about a narrative, we mean a story that we tell. And one way to think about the narrative self is it's the hero in the story I tell about myself. Yesterday I came to Sarah, and then today I'm sitting having a conversation with His Holiness, and tomorrow I'll be doing something different. And thinking of my life story as a kind of history of me. And that hero that I construct, a very constructed person, is what psychologists mean by a narrative self. Now, again, that doesn't mean it's a substantial self, sure, but it does indicate that many people confuse that story that they write about themselves with a substantial self. Yeah. And that's, of course, very important.
Yeah, precisely.
The point that you made... When Your Holiness is speaking about very simple animals...
That's the common sense. Then better not go...
too deeply into... His Holiness was saying that, we are talking about everyday phenomenal experience of everybody. So at that level, let's not talk about this deeper question of this kind of, eternal self or intrinsically real self.
The question that you posed about very fundamental, very small animals having a sense of self probably requires us to understand that sense of self more in the embodied sense than in the narrative sense. So I don't think that a mosquito is telling a story about itself. I don't think mosquitoes tell stories. Mosquito does have to orient itself in space and know where it is and be able to navigate, and so it may have an embodied sense of self, even if it's very primitive. And that's the sense Richie will come to in a moment.
Yeah, and so the embodied self, Your Holiness, is really a consequence of bottom up. These are mechanisms in the body which provide feedback to the brain and provide information to the brain on our orientation in space, on our motion, on the state of our autonomic nervous system, our heart, our lungs. All of that information is continuously being fed to the brain. And this is the what neuroscience calls introception. It is the perception of our internal bodily and visceral states, which give rise to what we think of as an embodied self. And this is something that presumably any sentient being would have.
No.
Yes.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you, we've been touching on the question of whether other... So in Your Holiness, we'll also over the course of the week, we will be addressing how the sense of self actually develops. And Vasu is a developmental psychologist expert on this, and she will be showing us some wonderful examples from little babies from the start of life and how our sense of self emerges from this. So we've also been talking about other species, and one of the ways in which scientists have studied one simple aspect of self in other species is called the mirror test. Your Holiness, this test has been tried with a number of different species, and recently it's been studied in a species that was difficult to do this test in because it required a very, very, very large mirror, and that's elephants. So we can show you how this works. And the way it works is that the elephant is makeup is used to draw an X on the elephant's face. And so the elephant is now being exposed to a mirror. And so the question is, does the elephant perceive him or herself in the mirror and actually touch the spot that's been marked, which would indicate some rudimentary sense of at least one aspect of self, or do they just respond to as if another elephant was in the mirror? So that's the question. And so we can show you this videotape.
だって、それだけやるじゃん。すずすず申しんば。うん。大変。大変。だな、たまらん。
So there's a big mirror in front of it. So this was some evidence.
One time, a friend of mine, when he feeds the dog, sometimes the dog won't eat. So to make him, eat.
Nice story connected with this friend, someone he knew well. This is a true story. He had a dog, and sometimes the dog wouldn't eat. And the one solution this person came up with was to have a big mirror and place it in front of the food, and then the dog feels threatened that some other dog is going to eat, and it eats the food.
Right. That's good. See, the dog would not pass the mirror test.
Yes. Right. Because the test, it fails you. The dog, the kid.
Two mothers.
The dog thinks it's another dog, not itself.
Yeah. Notice, of course, that that doesn't mean that the dog doesn't have an embodied sense of self, but it means that it doesn't connect its internal sense of self with anything it can perceive externally in a way that the elephant can and certain great apes can and human beings, of course, can and spend much too much time doing. Yeah.
Get the mic for mention.
But of course, dogs didn't pass the test so far, but there are surprising animals who pass the test, like magpie, the chaga,
chu,
and dolphins. Also, it's difficult to do so.
Dolphin da chu da the chaga sin chorus. Does it test the pass chorus?
And chai kachi get in the
differences among animals.
Yes.
Yeah. But again, we want to be careful. It's not necessarily a difference in whether they have an embodied sense of self, but whether they can coordinate, whether they can relate that inner sense of self to what they perceive externally. So it's a second order.
Sense of self in you with the
Devayuba.
Of course, I mean, if just one elephant can do it, that doesn't prove anything. So you have to test it on other elephants to make sure that the species pass the test.
Your Holiness, you're such a good scientist. and that was done in the actual study. This is just one example of one of the elephants that had been tested, but there are quite a few that have been tested, and they all passed the test. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, notice that one thing that we're doing here, if we remember that fourfold distinction that I drew between the person, the sense of self, the basis of the sense of self, and the idea or the projected idea of a self, most of what Ritchie is talking about now is the basis of the sense of self. What are the causes? What are the fundamental processes that give rise to a sense of self? Very little of that will touch the question of whether and why we posit a substantial self in a response to that. And it... So there remains a further very deep question about why we as human beings take something that we have constructed and then treat it as something that's independent and real. And one of the beauties of looking at this in the context of concepts and perception is that we tend to do the same thing with perception and concepts. When we perceive, we take something that we've constructed with our sense consciousness and treat it as though it's something independent and real. When we apply concepts, we treat the conceptual similarity we see as something real, even though that we've constructed it. And so that each of these three raise that very difficult question about what it is about human beings that leads us to constantly reify or to treat as independent and real not only our own selves, but the world around us and the categories into which we place things. And that, in a fundamental way, is what we're talking about.
And I think that really brings us full circle to back to the motivation for why we're here, and it is our aspiration that the increased understanding of these fundamental issues of perception, concepts, and the self will really help us to, and I think it's also a reason why scientists have been so attracted to Buddhism. Both traditions are interested in the fundamental nature of reality. And insofar as this dialogue will help us to better understand the fundamental nature of reality, we think it can contribute to the alleviation of suffering as more people develop this understanding.
Richie, thank you, Jay. Thank you so much. Thank you, Roshi.
So we're going to transition now into a...
Okay. Sound, yeah.
So I thanked Richie and Jay, and we're going to transition now into a presentation by Jinpa on the question from the early Indian perspective of does it match reality?
Yeah, the presentation, sure. Is it long enough? Is it long enough?
Or yes.
Do I need to move? How do I do this? I haven't used this.
Yeah. Thanks, there. John.
But this is independent of what's up there.
Yeah, it's okay. You kept us moving.
Yeah, that's it. And then how do you go back and forth? Okay. What? Okay. Can you go back? Okay. So, Your Holiness and... Your Eminence, Ganden Chö Rinpoche, Changpo Chö Rinpoche, and Shiazu Chö Rinpoche, and venerable members of the monastic community, fellow presenters, and guests. It's a great honor for me to be part of this conversation, and particularly a great joy as a former student of one of the monastic universities. It's a great pleasure for me to be presenting something on Dhammakirti's idea of perception. So before I begin, I would like to ask Your Holiness's permission so that I can step out of my traditional role as your interpreter and make this brief presentation in my own voice. I must also admit that I feel a little nervous because, it's not only Your Holiness, but also there is a presence of a great number of scholars such as Ganden Chö Rinpoche and Changtse Chö Rinpoche and Shapa Chö Rinpoche, as well as Gishin Shi Thapkela, all of these are great masters that have memorized Dharmakirti's text, studied, debated, taught, and meditated and embodied this great tradition for so many years, for 50, 60 years, and in their presence to be making this presentation is a little scary, and if in my presentation inadvertently I happen to make any misrepresentation, please forgive me. I just wanted to say that. And so my task is to really kind of, you know, in some sense, my presentation is not to Your Holiness or to the monastic community. It's really to the scientist presenters who are here, as well as the international guests who are participating and attending this conference. And my role is to really to set the stage, to give enough background to Buddhist epistemological thinking, particularly the important tradition of Dhammakirti's philosophy. We have divided our labor between John Dunn, who will be talking about concepts, formation, and language, and so on. Jay Garfield and Geshe-la will be talking about self, and Mathula will be bringing in, you know, what all of this perception, how it affects the way in which we experience the world and live in there. So we have divided our labor, but since I'm the first presenter, I'll be doing a kind of a more broad historical, you know, kind of background as well, so that there is, you know, I see my role more as a kind of a setting the stage, so that there's enough background for the subsequent dialogues that will unfold between the scientist and Your Holiness, as well as the other Buddhist presenters who are gathered here, so that this dialogue could really take place in a very rich way with a kind of a shared background. So I have divided my talk in four parts. First, I will give a very brief background, because when we talk about Buddhist perspectives on this and that, we are talking about an investigative tradition that goes back to the time of the Buddha himself, which is nearly 2,600 years ago. So we're talking about a very, very long period during which you have many great movements and trends and great thinkers as well. So to have a little historical background, to have us to step back, would be helpful. The second, I will then speak more specifically of my own chosen topic, which is perception. And then third, I will also talk about the subsequent developments after Dharmakirti, which has really made a big difference. And this includes the Tibetan tradition as well. You know, as His Holiness often points out, the Tibetan tradition is essentially the continuation of the Nalanda tradition. And the Tibetans have this self-conscious identity of its tradition as the custodians and continuers of the Nalanda tradition. So I'll be talking about subsequent developments. And then finally, I will end my brief presentation by listing some questions where I think there might be an interesting engagement between what is happening now in contemporary cognitive science, you know, including psychology, neuroscience, as well as linguistics, which is an important part of cognitive science in the West. And, you know, looking at the questions that are coming up that have been of major interest in the Dhammakirtian tradition, you know, where can we meet and what kind of challenges could be posed against each other. So I will end by listing some of those questions. So now, when we talk about something like perception, you know, we cannot really start with Dhammakirti and Dignaga. Dignaga is 5th century, Dhammakirti is 7th century. We have to really go back. So the first real systematic thinking, you know, and composition, compilation of text could really be placed sometime in the Abhidhamma period. And I'm being very, you know, kind of broad here, you know, very rough in my time estimation. So I want to make sure that my fellow Buddhist scholars don't, you know, take me to task for not being precise. But this is a very broad kind of presentation. So what is very unique about this Abhidhamma period, it's really the first period when a systematic compilation of the Buddha's discourses was done. And where one, you know, and related to our own topic here, what is interesting is the attempt to understand the nature and existence of the person in terms of what I refer to as five aggregates, five skandhas, which I've translated as five psychophysical aggregates, which constitutes the existence and identity of the person. You know, Jay and Richie were talking about the sources of the sense of self. This is essentially what we are talking about. These are the five main elements that constitute our existence, which serves as the basis for the sense of self. So these are material body, feelings, discrimination at a very, very basic level. I'm talking at a very, very fundamental, the ability to recognize something
and then mental formations and consciousness. So, and this is, I mean, of course, Abhidhamma is very, very large, but I'm selecting something that is relevant to our discussion here. Then part of the Abhidhamma movement, which again is relevant to our discussion here, is the development of detailed taxonomies of mind, and particularly in the framework, or within the framework, what is referred to as mind and mental factors. And mental factors is a technical term, but it, in a kind of an easy way, it, plain English, we could look at mental factors as the various modalities in which we experience the world through our mind. That's one way of looking at it. And then the third, more specifically relevant to my presentation, is how did the Abhidhamma, you know, thinkers understand perception? And here, when I use the term perception in the Abhidhamma context, we're really talking about sensory cognitions, sensory consciousness. And it's understood in terms of a causal process where three things come together. You have the external object, which is the stimulus. Then you have a sensory faculty, like the organs. And then you have an awareness. So these are the three conditions that give rise to an instance of perception. So this was a very, very early kind of pan-Buddhist understanding of how perception arises and what are the... So these are actually technically referred to as the three conditions. One is the objective condition, The other one, sensory faculty, is referred to as the empowering condition. And the third one is the referred to as the immediately preceding awareness. So, and now, you know, we have three conditions, but what distinguishes the uniqueness of each of the five sensory experiences are the uniqueness of the sensory faculties and the objects, not just the sensory faculties, but also objects. Now, some of the things that are coming out of science may challenge that uniqueness of the objects specific to the senses, but in the Buddhist tradition, not only the sensory faculties, but also objects were thought to be very unique to the individual senses. So the third condition, the awareness, is a common condition to all five sensory experiences. Now, on this model, the key is really the contact between the sense and the external object. That really is the key. And because of the need of this contact, there's even quite a sophisticated distinction drawn between the scope within which sensory faculties can reach. So visual perceptions can reach very far. Next comes the auditory and so on. So there is even that kind of detailed thinking that has gone on. So these are really the background which are being used by someone like Dignaga and Dharmakirti when they first formulate the Buddhist theory of systematic theory of perception. So, and Dignaga, according to the tradition, is really understood to be a student of Vasubandhu, and Vasubandhu was one of the great compilers of Abhidhamma texts. And so Dignaga is 5th century, so the first systematic, you know, writings on the theory of perception really emerges in Dignaga's writing in the 5th century. Now, Dignaga's views were further developed and refined, I would say, actually, by Dharmakirti in the 7th century, and particularly in a collection of texts known as the seven works of epistemology of Dignaga. And by the way, I don't want to promote this, but I have just recently edited all the seven texts of Dharmakirti together. So this is really, and in fact, it's only in Tibetan language all the seven texts of Dharmakirti survives. Some of the texts survive in Sanskrit, but the entire seven really survives only in Tibetan. So Dharmakirti, so therefore in the Indian tradition, not just among Buddhists, but also among the non-Buddhists, Dignaga and Dharmakirti came to be recognized as founders of the Buddhist epistemological tradition. They are known as the Pramana school, but epistemology is close enough translation, although Pramana also includes logic.
So we tend to sometimes use logic and epistemology, but that's a long word. So to use short form, we can just call it the epistemological school. For the benefit of the scientist here, why do we think, someone like myself and Jay and John Dunn, why do we think that Dhammakirti is worth looking at? You know, this 7th century great thinker, why should contemporary cognitive scientists care about someone like Dhammakirti? Now, if you look at the typical questions that Dhammakirti and Dignaga have really tried to address, these are questions that are central concerns for current cognitive science. How does our perception represent the world? It's as basic a question as this. And then there are questions like, do our senses give direct access to the actual world, or are our perceptual knowledge always mediated? The question just Richie raised, is there such a thing as an unconstructed experience, even though it may be a very short moment? These are important questions. Even now, the scientists are struggling, cognitive scientists. But these were questions that have been addressed in the 7th century. Then another question is, how are the information received through our senses integrated in our cognition? When we experience the world, when we perceive the world, we have an integrated experience. We don't see the world in a disjunct way. We see the world in an integrated way. How is that information coming through the senses organized in such a way that our experience of the world is integrated and unified? What role does memory play in this experience? Is the ability to perceive a world require a prior experience which then inclines us to recognize when we see it next, which then creates this, awareness? Where does memory come in? And then how concepts are formed. And this is something that John would be more specifically dealing with. And what is the status of, the relationship between the concept that we have and the world out there that the concept refer to? And so how does, and the other question is, how does thought, which is mediated by concept, relate to the world? So these are the questions that Dhammakirti and Dignaga, as well as there are other non-Buddhist peers in the Nyayaka tradition other traditions, they have struggled. Mimamsaka as well, another important player in this whole discussion. And what is the connection between thought, language, and reality? Again, a major concern, for the philosophers for a long time in the West, as well as in the East, now for the scientists. And great minds like Dhammakirti and Dignaga have struggled with these questions, and the Buddhist traditions have carried this on, which the Tibetans have inherited, and Tibetans have carried on further. There's a whole history of development of thinking in this area. So, it makes no sense for those in the cognitive science not to be at least taking a look at this. Otherwise it looks as if everybody is trying to start from the fresh. Everybody is trying to reinvent the wheel. So looking at the way in which cognitive scientists are looking at these questions now without showing any awareness of this kind of thinking, for me at least, it feels really weird. Of course, there is the barrier of language because the texts are not fully translated and so on. So this is my argument that what is happening in Dhammakirti and Dignaga's writing is really, dealing with the central questions that are also of interest and concern in contemporary cognitive science. And then the method that we see in Dhammakirti is, again, quite similar to what we see in current cognitive science. The current cognitive science uses a multiple discipline, whereas Dhammakirti uses philosophy, psychology, and linguistics. The linguistics of Sanskrit, based on Sanskrit, is a key component of Dhammakirtian epistemology. Now, in contemporary cognitive science, you have one additional discipline, which is artificial intelligence, which, of course, was not invented at the time of Dhammakirti. Otherwise, he would have used that too. So what I want to show is not only are there synergy at the level of asking questions, but even at the level of methodology, there's a real similarity between Dhammakirtian approach and current cognitive science approach. So let me now go more specifically into my central topic, which is perception. And before I begin, I want to acknowledge, as we had the discussion before, that we need to be careful. And Jay has been warning us to watch out for the way in which we mean the word that we're using. And we need to keep in mind maybe the differences in which the word perception is being used, sometimes by scientists and sometimes by us. So I'm going to put in a very, very crude, simple way some of the fundamental premises of Dharmakirtian thinking. Here, Dharmakirtian thinking kind of basically makes the assumption that our knowledge of the world can come only through two ways. One is our senses, one is our thought. And this idea, epistemological view, is correlated with a unique ontology. And this is something that is unique to Dharmakirtian thinking, where you have the lived world is made up of unique particulars that are real. So what is real are the unique particulars. And then there are general characteristics which are actually unreal in terms of their status, but that are constructed by our language and thought onto the real world. And senses, or the perception, and concepts really relate to these, you know, correlate to each other. So our perception and senses relate to the unique particulars, and our thought and concepts relate to these general characteristics. So to summarize this, you have perception that relates to the real particulars, you have thought or concepts that relate to general characteristics. And general characteristics are always characteristics that are extracted and imposed, you know, upon the real world. The real world is only made up of very unique individuals at a specific time, place, and so on. So therefore, the real particulars are the only ones that are causally efficient, because the general characteristics are all constructed by our thought. You know, the causally efficient ones are the ones that are real particulars, and they are also momentary. They only last for a moment, and they are utterly unique. They are utterly unique in terms of space, time, and nature, and they are essentially inexpressible, because the moment we try to express something, it has already moved on, and also our limitation imposed by language, you know, prevents us from being able to articulate in its entirety. So these unique particulars are completely, you know, inexpressible, essentially. So these are the key ideas, and I think also when listening to John Dunn's presentation, to have these background ideas in our mind is really helpful where Dharmakirti is coming from. So more specifically in that question, how does someone like Dignaga and Dharmakirti define perception? What do they mean by perception? The Tibetan word is ngonsum. The Sanskrit word is pratyaksha. What do they mean by, you know, perception? And Dharmakirti has this very simple definition. Dignaga has this very simple definition. He says perception is free of conceptuality. And conceptuality involves associating names and categories or classes to its object. So in other words, perceptions do not involve any of that associations of names and classes, and it's only thought and concepts that bring names and you know, categories and class distinctions. Dharmakirti adds another component to the definition, which is that perception is not only free from conceptuality, but also it must be undistorted. And this is an interesting point, because you were asking about whether or not there could be an veridical perception. Dharmakirti would definitely say yes. Dharmakirtin, you know, epistemology would say veridical perception. I mean, what do we mean by veridical is something else. And then another important point to remember is Dignaga and Dharmakirti are proponents of what is known as a causal theory of perception. So when we have a perception, an object, the perception and the object it perceives are not simultaneous. They are subsequent. So a perception is always a consequence of the object that triggers that perception. So, and here, you know, how does that causality work? I quote from my colleague here, John Donne's book, which I think captures that really well. And, quote, when perception occurs, a sensory object acts as a contributing cause for the production of a cognition in which an image of that sensory object appears. So in other words, when senses come into contact with an object, the object acts as a catalyst and imprints a kind of a phenomenal image to the senses, and this is what actual perception means. Simple now. And so therefore, the object that is being perceived is always consequent, subsequent to the actual perception itself. And so it's not a simultaneous relationship. This, I think, is an important point because it has implications down the line. Now, why would Dhammakirti insist of adding this second component, undistorted? So Dignaga was only, you know, kind of had free of conceptuality. Dhammakirti adds this undistorted. What Dhammakirti wants to do is to preclude from the matua, the matua. So because he wants to preclude from genuine perceptions these kind of perceptions. You know, this is a ring of fire. Essentially, there's only one flame which you would, you know, turn around very swiftly, and what you see is a ring of flame, but there is no ring of flame. And for Dhammakirti, this is a distorted perception, so it's not a true perception. So therefore, for Dhammakirti, Pratyaksha is not only free of conceptuality, but also it is free from this kind of distortion. Now, in Western cognitive science and psychology, you have theories of illusion, but those kind of theories of illusions are slightly different. I mean, here you have rabbit and duck, so depending on how you look at it. But Dhammakirtin, you know, thinker would argue that this kind of illusions operate at the level of mind, because you are talking at the level of interpretation, not at the level of sensory experience. Whereas for Dhammakirti, the distorted perceptions are really at the level of senses themselves. It's not an interpretation, but it is at the level of senses. And now, the reason why he wouldn't qualify them as genuine perception is because they are distorted. They don't reflect the reality accurately. Now, the phrase "reflecting the reality accurately" is problematic. What does it mean? That, you know, we can discuss that later. But essentially, Dhammakirti makes a distinction between distorted perceptions and genuine perceptions. And Dhammakirti would argue that in the case of distorted perceptions, so he gives many examples. So, for example, if you are sitting on a boat and the boat is moving, you see the trees on the land moving backwards. And then there is a famous example of people suffering with some kind of ophthalmic diseases. They see falling hairs in front of them where there's no hair. And similarly, people suffering from jaundice or other illnesses sees a white conch yellow. So he would argue that in these cases, you know, the distortion is really built into the very mechanism of perception itself, that no amount of thinking bringing in is going to help you get over that distortion. And that means the distortion is happening at the level of perceptual mechanism itself. Whereas if you have other types of distortion where, for example, if you see a coiled rope and you are afraid there's a snake, you freak out and then you go closely, you check, you recognize it's a coiled rope. There, Dhammakirti would say the distortion is at the level of mind, because by reinterpreting, you can get over the distortion. Whereas in these kind of distortions, no amount of thinking brought in can make any difference to remove the distortion. So the distortion, that means, is really at the very fundamental level, at the mechanism of the perception themselves. Now, let's look at the other component, which is being free of conceptuality. And this is where there's going to be a lot more debate and discussions with cognitive science. Dharmakirti is saying that perception, at least the initial instance, is free of any form of determination or articulation of the perceptual content. You know, it doesn't involve any form of class-based identification nor language-based identification, like this is blue, I'm seeing blue, or attributing different properties to it, like this is beautiful, this doesn't look right. All of these are really subsequent to the perceptual experience. The first moment of perception is just sensing of that object in front of you, and at that stage, there is no conceptual processing. It is pure sensory experience. So this is a direct quote from Dharmakirti himself, and this is from the Savitri, the auto-commentary. Perception does not determine in any way at all. What it grasps, it does not determine. What does it do then? It perceives. Hence, it is not through determination that perception grasps or does not grasp. So perception's primary function is to simply perceive. And that's all it does. And all the other interpretation and articulation of the perceptual content is subsequent to that experience. And so this... Now, Dharmakirti, how do we get to this? How would you argue for the presence of that kind of, you know, pure sensing level of perception? Dharmakirti proposes an interesting thought experiment, and, you know, George Dreyfus calls it the perceptual reduction argument. And this involves the suggestion that if you are sitting in front of something, looking at an object, and if you are able to then withdraw all your thought processes, you know, try to sort of shut it down, and finally, you know, kind of basically slow down the energy, restless energy of the thought processes, and simply be aware of the object in front of you. At some point, when the thought ceases, there is still the perception of the object in front of you. And he says, this is just pure sensing. So here, this is a direct quote from Dharmakirti in Pramana Vartika. So, So this is directly from Dharmakirti himself. Says, withdrawing one's mind from everything else with no movements of thought at all, even when in such a state one sees the object in front of you, this cognition is sense-born. So this is a reduction. So from your thought level simply to the level of just being aware of what's in front of you. And then he says that when later, slowly thoughts return, one then identifies one's own conceptuality and knows that this conceptualizing was absent for the previously mentioned sensory cognition. So in other words, it's a kind of a perceptual reduction experiment, each person. And he suggests that you could do it yourself. So each of us can close our eyes and slow it down. Not close, you have to look at the object in front. So this is one, and he has series of arguments, other arguments, but this is one interesting argument, which is sort of a phenomenologically based argument, which and attempts to argue that there is such a thing as the first moment, pure sensing, you know, moment of perception. Now, Dharmakirti's thought has been really influential, but on the other hand, this insistence on perceptions being free of conceptuality, free of any form of determination, creates a lot of tension in Dharmakirti's own thinking. And one tension is really coming from the other important part of his theory, which is the theory of knowledge. You know, what constitutes valid cognition is how we translate. Is valid cognition is defined as a reliable cognition. And he would want to include both perception and inference as belonging to the category of valid cognition. So in other words, even perceptions have to be a form of knowledge. So then if perceptions are just pure sensing and no interpretation, how can they perform the role of being a knowledge? That's an important tension in Dhammakirti. And when he talks about reliability, he gives two definitions, two meanings. One is a practical or a pragmatic meaning of being reliable. He says cognition is valid insofar as it helps us fulfill our desired aims. So that's a very pragmatic criteria of what means for a cognition to be reliable. The second is more cognitive. It says it is valid if and only if it indicates correctly the object we are seeking. So one is kind of, you know, cognitive. The other one is pragmatic. Now, the question is, if for a cognition to be valid, it needs to be able to help us fulfill our desired aims, then how can a pure sensing of an object in front of us constitute a form of knowledge and help us fulfill our aims? Because to fulfill our practical aims, we need to be able to, you know, use categories, make distinctions based on categories, and correctly recognize the object we are seeking is the one that is in front of us. So that's an important tension for Dhammakirti. And also, the second part becomes also problematic. What does it mean to say that valid cognition will indicate? If perception is a pure sensing, what kind of role of indicating it does? So this is an important tension, and Dhammakirti himself was aware of this. And, you know, this is a direct quote from him, where he says, well, now how can there be practical action from perception whose nature is not that of determination? One could not engage in a practical action because one acts in order to obtain things that cause happiness and avoid things that cause suffering only when one has made the determination. So in other words, he has this idea that all of us are driven by our desire to avoid problems, our desire to seek what is good for us, and that is the primary motive, and our sensory experiences help us, particularly the valid ones, you know, fulfill that aim. But fulfilling that aim requires being able to make a determination of the objects. And if the senses don't make the determination, how can it help us fulfill the practical aims? And that's a serious tension Dhammakirti himself recognizes. And he responds to this. This is translation from John Donne's book. And he says, this poses no problem, since just when one sees the object, there occurs a perceptual judgment. Now he is relying on what comes after. So perceptual judgment that arises due to that awareness, and due to that perceptual judgment, practical action occurs because of one's desire. So in other words, you have a causal chain. You have the object in front of you that triggers a sensory experience. That sensory experience immediately gives rise to a perceptual judgment. Now we're at the level of thought and mind, and this perceptual judgment then makes us engage with the object. So there is a causal process. All of this will be very, very swift, as His Holiness pointed out, because the mental processes, the speed is very, very fast, but still there are distinct stages in the process. So Dhammakirti's way of resolving this tension was not to attribute ability to determine to the perception itself, but to argue that the perception immediately brings up perceptual judgment afterwards, which then help us achieve our aim. I personally don't think the solution is compelling, because it sort of bypasses the problem. Now, there are other tensions in Dhammakirti thinking, one of which is that real particulars are momentary, but then the perceptions we experience tend to be about temporarily extended things. So if perceptions are only relating to the real things which are only momentary, then how can we account for the temporarily extended nature of the objects that we experience? So that's an important tension. The other one is, if what perception and grasp is only momentary, how can it help fulfill our aim? Because the momentary things don't fulfill our aim. Our full aims are fulfilled by everyday objects, like this computer in front of me, you know, these reading glasses. So these are temporarily extended things. Those are the ones that help us fulfill our aim. And another important tension is that, as explained before, the causal theory of perception suggests that there is an imprint that the perception, you know, takes of the object. And so this is the likeness. If Dhammakirti insists that the perceptions are undistorted, the imprint is singular, but the objects that the imprint relates to are in reality composed of multiple particles. So again, there is no true correspondence between the objects of perception and the imprint that the perception carries. Similarly, causal theory seems to suggest that our experience, our perception of the object is only indirectly, because it is not simultaneous. It is indirectly, it's consequent to the, you know, to the object. So in that sense, how can we actually talk about it as being direct experience, direct perception? So these are important tensions. And then finally, you know, if perceptions and thought relate to two completely dichotomous aspects of reality, one is to the real things, the other one is to the constructed attributes that we impose, then how can we explain the integrated nature of our cognitive experience? So these are important tensions in Dhammakirti's thinking. How am I doing with time? Yeah? You're fine. Okay. So all of these tensions are very important tensions in Dhammakirtian thinking, and this is what has led to further developments in the Dhammakirtian thinking. And one of the key personalities in that movement is Dharmottara of the 8th century. There are others, but I'm choosing only one. And because his thought is particularly influential, and Chujo. His thought is particularly important in the Gelug monastic universities like Sera, Drepung, and Ganden, because Gelsabje's thinking is very deeply influenced by Dharmottara's writing. So Dharmottara tries to really kind of grapple with all of these problems in Dhammakirtian, you know, theory of perception. And one interesting thing that he does is to really tease out the different functions, aspects of the function of, you know, the cognition. So he says that function of valid cognition is to indicate the object, really to indicate the object. And the indicating the object consists of ascertaining. So he now brings back determination into perception, which in turn leads to obtainment of the object. And it is this obtainment of the object that facilitates the fulfillment of our desired aim. So he has indicating and then ascertaining and then obtaining the object. And then this indicating works differently. In the case of perception, indicating is done through seeing. So here we're using visual perception as the primary kind of, you know, paradigm. And in the case of thought, it is done through ascertainment. So indicating is done differently. In the case of sensory experiences, it is done through actual sensing. And in the case of inference, it is done through ascertainment. And another thing that he does is to distinguish between two types of object to every cognition. So he has a grasped object, which is one perceives, and determined object. So what he's trying to do is to, he's trying to create some kind of commonality between the perceptual experience and the subsequent thought and conceptual cognition. And he would want to find a kind of a shared object that would unite the two. Because in Dhammakirtian thinking, they were very different. Now, Dharmottara wants to at least bring one object that is shared by both. So that would make sense that there is a greater synergy. And what he does is to say
that the grasped objects are distinct, but the determined objects are the same. So, for example, if you have a perception of, you know, say, this glass in front of you, the grasped object of the perception is the unique particular, which is not accessible to thought at all. But the determined object is the everyday object, glass in front of you, both for the visual perception as well as for the subsequent perceptual judgment. And because the perception and the subsequent judgment share the same determined object, there is a unity in the experience. Of course, how much of that is being very faithful to Dhammakirti is another question, but at least that seems to solve the problem. And so this is basically what I explained before, that at the level of perceptual object, there's a distinction, difference, but at the level of determined object, they are the same. And then he wants to maintain, you know, faithful to Dhammakirti. So he says that perception does not determine the object by itself, but it does so by turning over the function of seeing to the subsequent judgment. So therefore, the subsequent judgment is able to give rise to the thought, this is blue. And to have that recognition that this is blue is a very complex process according to this model. Because first of all, you need to have this desire of seeking out something. You also need to have prior experience of having seen blue. And then you need to have this visual perception of the blue in front of you. And then immediately giving rise to the perceptual judgment. Only then can you say, ah, this is blue. So it's a complex process. And here he uses a beautiful metaphor, actually. He says, riding the carriage of perceptual cognition, perception determines its object. So it's temporarily, it's problematic because perception is prior, but it's by depending upon the perceptual judgment. And one could say that whether or not that particular perception has the ability to immediately give rise to a perceptual judgment would determine whether or not that perception is valid. And so through this kind of revision, a new trend emerges in Buddhist epistemology with a move towards greater accommodations of everyday experience and greater realism, actually. So there's an attempt to make sense of the everyday experience in a meaningful way so that you don't go too far in your epistemological model. It's because your epistemological model would want to at least be seen as giving an account of our everyday experience and also provide a unified explanation of our integrated experience. Now, it is this revised trend of Dhammakirtian thinking that the Tibetans inherited. So you have first in Tibet, the real epistemological tradition began, although the texts themselves, some of them were translated as early as 8th, 9th century, but the real epistemological thinking systematically emerged in the 11th century with Ngoc school. Ngoc Lhotshawala Nyingcharap is the key person there. And then Chapa Chögyi Singye is the other key person. And by the way, Chapa is the one who is credited with inventing the Tibetan debate system with all the physical posture, the screaming and the shouting, all of that very kind of energetic display of debating was invented by Chapa. So Ngoc and Chapa were the key two masters of this early Tibetan epistemological school. Then the second period of Tibetan epistemological school is Sakya Pandita in the late 12th century, early 13th century. And his move is quite different, actually. Sakya Pandita rejected this revision of Dhammakirti, and in some sense, he went back to Dhammakirti and his more literal interpretation of Dhammakirti and sought to resolve many of the tensions in Dhammakirti, not by changing Dhammakirtian system, but trying to find solutions within Dhammakirti's own thinking,
whereas Dharmottara and the Tibetan, other Tibetans have moved on, brought on new kind of ideas, including, for example, like implicit cognition versus explicit cognition. There's another invention that was brought by the Ngoc school, which Sapen rejects, whereas Ngoc school would insist that there are even perceptions, you know, even direct perceptual experiences can have absence as an object. And the third period is the Gelug school, which the Sayadaw Monastery is a major example of that tradition. And Gelug school, in a sense, can be seen as continuation of the Ngoc tradition, but innovations and great influence coming from the Dharmottara's revised tradition. And the key players, you know, masters in that tradition are Gyaltsap and Kretup. And Gyaltsap's text really constitutes a main textbook in the Gelug monastic universities when it comes to epistemology. So I hope I have presented kind of a broad kind of, you know, background, and also to look at, you know, some of the tensions that are inherent in this tradition and the attempts that have been made by subsequent thinkers to resolve them. And so let me conclude by just raising some questions which might be of interest to contemporary cognitive scientists. So to what extent some version of Dhammakirti's correlating of perception with real things and thought with constructed general characteristics is unavoidable in any attempt to understand the connection between cognition and actual reality? Because, you know, I mean, our common sense intuition tells us, you know, there is a real world independent of our perception, you know, our idiosyncratic individual perception. But at the same time, we do know that a large part of the categories are imposed by us onto the world. So given that distinction, to what extent this Dhammakirtian distinction between thought versus perception is unavoidable? Another thing is, you know, to what extent Dhammakirti's perceptual reduction argument convincing as a demonstration of the presence of at least an initial moment of concept-free, you know, perception or a sensation? I mean, that's an interesting, question. And I don't know whether, you know, experimentally we can look at this, but at least to me, the argument is quite compelling.
You don't mean it's construct-free?
No, not construct-free. Sorry, that concept-free. Yeah, construct is complicated, yeah. And then another question is, if you look at the Buddhist theory of perception, it's a very active theory of perception. It's not a passive mirroring. You know, our expectations, our desires play and influence our perception, and perceptions allow us to make discriminations, and recognition and memory plays a part. Then the fulfillment of aim and desired goal is part of the perceptual kind of thinking. So how does contemporary psychology's, you know, approach relate to that? And then how would contemporary cognitive scientists relate to this extensive debates within the Indo-Tibetan epistemological thinking on whether perception can ever have a determining nature? You know, can perception be just about sensing, or can perception also be kind of, you know, rich in its content, loaded with categories, you know, full of information that thought unpacks? So there's a big debate that has gone on. And how does the long Tibetan, Indo-Tibetan inquiry into the relationship between perception and thought in creating an integrated experience of world relate to the current debates in cognitive science between innatism versus constructivism? There is a big debate going on to what extent, I mean, on the one hand, there are some proponents who are saying that all the concepts are inborn. You know, we bring the concepts, you know, innately. But then on the other hand, there are others who argue that almost every concept is a constructed. And, you know, maybe there is a balance somewhere. So how does this Dhammakirtian debate really relate to this? And finally, you know, how would Dhammakirtian theory of perception relate to the current neuroscientific understanding of perception and its functions? Because one thing that we notice is that in all of this, there is no discussion of the role of brain.
And one signature contribution that comes from modern science is the understanding of the brain processes that are involved in perception, thought, and so on. So so with that, and these are, of course, open questions, and hopefully it will stimulate the conversation as we, you know, move forward. Thank you. Tujiche. Excellent. Was saying that I had done a very good homework.
Yes.
Jinpa, thank you so much. Richie, Jay, thank you. So we're going to take some time for lunch. It's almost 11:30, and I want to just indicate that the afternoon session will return here a little before 1 o'clock, and the session will run from 1 to 3. And Pavan, we look forward to hearing from you. And that there will be no separate tea break. Is that right, Wendy? Today, just today. And in front of this hall, there will be a special event, monastic debates on science topics put on by the Sarah J. Science Center, and tea will be served in the course of that. So I want to thank the three of you so much. This very sophisticated early Indian perspective brings up so many questions that are important for us as we begin to unpack the neuroscience of perception, concept formation, and what we mean by the self. And Jay, thank you so much as well. And Your Holiness,